Welcome to this special limited series about Israeli settlements, together with the Israel Office of the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. I'm Dahlia Shenlin, and we will be exploring the historic evolution and current status of Israeli settlements and potential future developments. Each episode represents a different aspect, and today we'll be discussing what Israeli settlements mean for those people who live in them, Israeli settlers. Our guest today represents one of the hottest spots in a very hot conflict. Yishai Fleischer is the international spokesperson for the Jewish community of Hebron, where we are recording this interview. He's a broadcaster and columnist. He holds a law degree from Cardozo Law School and rabbinic ordination. He served as a paratrooper in the IDF, and his parents were Russian refuseniks. Yishai, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dahlia. It's great to be with you.
Here we are at the Tomb of the Patriarchs and the Matriarchs and the Ibrahimi Mosque. Why are we here? Actually, why are you and the Jewish community of Hebron here?
Well, every nation's got a narrative, a foundational narrative. And the foundational narrative of the Jewish people is pillared right here. You have a tomb that basically more than 4 billion people around the world agree is the tomb of Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah. Both Islam and Christianity do not dispute the Jewish version of the events, which is laid out in the beginnings of it, is laid out in chapter 23 in the book of Genesis, with the purchase of the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs by Abraham from the Hittites who were stationed here in Hebron. And he negotiates, that's 3,800 years ago, negotiates for this plot of land to bury his beloved wife, Sarah. Later, it becomes a sepulcher for the rest of the, what I call the first family. And Abraham, when he passes away, he's buried here, according to the biblical narrative, by both Isaac and Ishmael. Now, the Jewish version is that Ishmael is the father of the Arabs, and the Arabs don't dispute that. And so the next father of the Jews, Isaac, together with the father of the Arab nation, together bury our joint father Abraham here. And then after that, Isaac and Rebekah are buried here, and then Leah, and finally Jacob, whose other name is Israel, is buried in this plot of land. That's the end of the book of Genesis. When Jacob is laying, dying in Egypt, he says, please bury me in Hebron. He lays out the whole story of the purchase and who's buried there. And he says, take me there. And that's basically how the book ends. So you can understand that this mighty monument is one that is a monument to our peoplehood. But it's also a monument to one man amongst all those people that I mentioned is Abraham. And Abraham, as I said, is the father of the Jews and father of the Arabs. His name means father of many nations, Av Hamon Goyim, we say in Hebrew, the Bible says. And so this place is actually a place that Arabs and Jews can get together around something that's common to us. And I think that it's not a coincidence that as we're recording this, it's just a few days after the UAE-Bahrain-Israel-Abraham Accords. And that's named after somebody, Abraham, the first monotheist, who basically brings Arabs and Jews together and really the people of this region. And so that's why we're here.
And does that explain why the community, the Jewish community of Hebron, which some would consider a very controversial settlement, is here?
Well, it's kind of funny that the Jewish community of Hebron would be controversial since it's the oldest, longstanding Jewish community that the Jewish people have anywhere. And we're talking really about 3,000 years of continuous Jewish life here, which has been corroborated by various travelers. We're standing right here where the Maimonides, Rambam, was here in 1165. We know exactly which day, the 9th of Cheshvan. He was right here. And right next to this building, the building itself is a 2,000-year-old building built by King Herod, well-described in Josephus. And before that, King David was king here. Jews have been in this place forever and ever. So it's kind of funny that it would be contentious that Jews would live here since they've always lived here. And if Jews were Christians, we would call the Jews of Hebron the Knights of the Machpelah, the Knights of the protectors of the Machpelah. That's the biblical term for this monument, which means the double cave. And so the Jewish people have been the protectors of this place for century after century, through good times and bad times. And so to us, it's a bit funny to consider this ancient community controversial when it's really the foundational community of the people of Israel.
Okay, so I think the controversy comes from the fact that not only is the community here, but the state of Israel is here as well. Why is the state of Israel here?
Well, the state of Israel has an interest in being a Jewish state in the land of Israel. I mean, I don't know. I don't think you want me to go through the essential pillars of Zionism, but if we have to, in short, it's to establish a Jewish state on the land of Israel. And so the essential heartland of the Holy Land is Hebron. So, of course, the state of Israel will want to be here, just like it would want to be in Jerusalem. And I don't think anybody's asking, well, why would the state of Israel want to be in Jerusalem? Of course it wants to be in Jerusalem. And it wants to be in the foundational historical cities that include places like Beit El or Bethel or Shechem, which is known in the Arab world as Nablus, or other cities that are the essential narrative historical pillars of Jewish history in the land of Israel. That's where the Jewish state wants to exist. If it didn't exist here, it would exist in Uganda or somewhere else, or in Brooklyn. But it chooses, the state of Israel wants to protect Jewish rights and ensure Jewish culture in the land of Israel. The essential land of Israel is here.
Okay, so what's the problem with all that? I mean, Hebron is also... I'm going to ask you about the context of Hebron in particular before we get into the bigger issues. Hebron is, if I'm not mistaken, one of the biggest or the biggest Palestinian city. And that is where we come into the problem of who is sovereign and how the populations live together. From your perspective, what is the situation in Hebron before we zoom out and talk about settlements and politics?
Well, it's hard to distinguish between those two things.
Can you characterize just how life is managed here in Hebron?
Well, today there's about 200,000 Arabs that live in Hebron and its environs, including the city of Chalchul and other villages around. Within that big city of Hebron, there's a small Jewish community. Let's call it a Jewish quarter, if you will. And that Jewish quarter comprises about 1,000 Jews. With our neighboring sister city of Kiryat Arba, we're a block of about 10,000 Jews living amongst about 200,000 Arabs. So we're actually the only Jewish presence within a Palestinian Authority-controlled Arab city. There is no other examples of that. And I'll explain later maybe how the Palestinian movement in its various forms is really a movement for ethnically cleansing Jews and always has been. And it at every turn has managed to ethnically cleanse Jews from the land of Israel. Hebron, after the Six-Day War, saw that a group of people who yearned to come back to, as I said before, the essential heartland, and began the process of quote-unquote settling or resettling here in Hebron after the community was destroyed in the 1929 Hebron massacre, which ended up murdering 67 Jews and effectively ended Jewish communal life after 3,000 years of continuous presence here. And so that was 1929. Just a few years later, 1967, there was the natural yearning to rebuild here. But as is obvious, it was also a major Arab city. In the 90s, left-leaning Israeli governments went towards a process of trying to divide the land of Israel and to create a Palestine or a Palestinian Authority that would control the large amount of Arabs that live in these parts. And within that were the 1997 Hebron Accords, which divided the town into a Palestinian Authority-controlled part and then a Jewish autonomous part, or autonomous in the sense autonomous from the Palestinian Authority, but part of the State of Israel. However, an interesting facet of Hebron is that the municipal infrastructure, the garbage and the water and things like that, is run by the Palestinian Authority controlled city. The municipal PLO, basically, is who runs the infrastructure. So we have a lot of kind of funny things that happen here because we sometimes need, you know, a road fixed and here comes a Palestinian Authority crew to fix it. For example, like 2 years ago, I had some of my Brooklyn Syrian Jewish donors here and some of them had left Syria and Lebanon, in the 90s. And so these are fluent Arabic speakers. And we had a Palestinian Authority crew here fixing up the site. And immediately they got into the conversation. They slipped somebody 100 shekel in order to do something nicer or make it even better. And everybody was just happy as a clam because they understood one another. So that's some of the funny, let's call it coexistence, that happens in the city of Hebron.
Who governs, in terms of law and law enforcement, the Jews who live here?
Well, the Jews are, there's basically three, just like there's areas A, B, and C when it comes to Judea and Samaria / the West Bank, We also have here basically three subsets. We have H1, which is Hebron controlled by the Palestinian Authority. And that means that the civil and security control is theirs. Then we have H2, where the Arabs living in H2 area of Hebron are under the civil authority of the Palestinian Authority, but security is maintained by the Israeli army. So that's about 40,000 Arabs that see the Israeli army patrol in their neighborhoods, and that's so that they don't shoot down or snipe down at the Jewish community, which is in an area that we euphemistically, because it's not exactly written to law, but that's what it is in practice, is called H3, which is the 2-kilometer-long quarter that we have here. And the Jews that live here vote in the state of Israel. They serve in the Israeli army, but they're not exactly controlled by the regular Israeli regime, but rather by a quasi-army regime, which is called the civil authority, which means that, for example, when you try to purchase a house here, it has to be cleared by the civil authority and then the defense ministry. And so it's not regular Israel exactly. So there's an ambivalence because on the one hand, it is a big Arab city. And there was for many years the idea of a two-state solution. We'll get to that later, but we certainly were and continue to be against that idea.
What was supposed to happen in the two-state solution that you were against?
Well, we're against any other sovereign in the land of Israel, certainly west of the Jordan River towards the Mediterranean. We don't believe that there should be or could be any other sovereign here, any sovereign, including a friendly sovereign, and certainly a non-friendly sovereign like we see in the Palestinian Authority / Hamas, like we see in Gaza. We were always against that. But the bottom line is that the Jewish people exist here. The Jewish community, as I said before, a pillar community for the whole history of the Jewish people. But we still live within a certain ambivalence, or there's an ambivalent relationship of the state of Israel towards us here. Because on the one hand, everybody understands that this shrine is so foundational. And everybody understands that if you wipe out Jewish life in Hebron, it's like you wiped out Jewish life in Jerusalem.
Okay, but if Jews are living here, first of all, can you finish the part about the 2 kilometers where Jews live? Are there Palestinians living there or are there none?
Yes, there are Palestinians that live within that 2-kilometer radius. And they live with a greater security control status around here. That's because we have faced thousands of attacks, knife attacks, rock attacks, murderous attacks. We've had maybe dozens of our members of our community over the years murdered. And so, especially in light of the 1929 massacre. And so therefore, there's heightened security on this 2-kilometer strip. Remember, Hebron is actually 20 kilometers squared. The 2 kilometer long area is a small quarter, which is a protected status for the Jews that live here, which have been under fire so many times. So therefore, there's heightened security here. So the Palestinians that live here can go to Arab Hebron and certainly cross that checkpoint all the time. The checkpoint is much, much faster to get through than any airport security. But yes, when they enter this area, there's a heightened security, just like the whole state of Israel is in the end, a heightened security towards Arabs, because the Jewish people want to protect themselves in this land.
So does this settlement, and in general, do you think Israeli Jewish settlements bring security to Israel? Do they help Israel's security? Are they needed for security?
Well, first thing, I don't think we do everything for security. And okay. I think that that's just a misnomer. And it was Ariel Sharon who was quoted in The Atlantic who said that I made a mistake, he writes, that I overstressed the security element. We're not here just because of security. We're here because we've always been here. And we're here because this is the essential heartland. We're here because our forefathers and mothers are buried here. I'm not saying that I don't understand what your sense is. I understand what you're saying, but Dad is buried here. Mom is buried here. This is where we're from. And so that's aspect number one. And to answer your question more directly about security, there's not even a question in any serious military-minded person in their mind that, of course, Jews that live in Judea and Samaria in the West Bank bring security. In this town, this town, which is run by the PLO, has a great a presence of Hamas. It's like 80% Hamas voters and believers of the Arabs that live in Hebron. And so if we weren't here, this would be the next Gaza overnight. Overnight. Remember how Hamas operates. They don't just get everybody excited and riled up about their opinion. They quash the liberal-minded folks, the Arabs who don't think their way. And overnight, this would become a storehouse for rockets, and it would be the next Gaza. And this is, of course, very close to Jerusalem, and would control the whole mountain range, including Jerusalem and below it. So,
and the settlements help that situation?
Of course, because by having a Jewish community here, that draws the army and draws the security services into it. They ensure that the Jewish community is secure. And by the way, it's important to know that while we're only 10,000 Jews living here, we also are the gateway towards over 1 million visitors a year to this site. So it's in argumentation, you could say you're only 10,000 Jews. No, we open the door for over 1 million visitors a year to come here and to worship and to have pilgrimage and to connect Muslims from Indonesia, from Turkey, Christians from all over the world.
What about Palestinians from H1 to H2?
So Palestinians come here all the time. They have here.
How do they get from H1 to H2?
No, H1 and H2 are connected. That's not even a problem. The only problem is more like the H3. How do you get in? But they never even have to pass that area in order to enter the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. They come right from, there's two other entrances to the Tomb of Patriarchs and Matriarchs. They never see any army presence until they enter the actual complex of the tomb to make sure that they're not armed, and that's for their security as well.
But we should also point out that there are major checkpoints between the different sectors of Hebron. And these are
I would amend that to say, in order to, within Arab Hebron, there are no checkpoints.
But to cross
in order
sectors.
To walk into the Jewish quarter, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that that's perfectly legitimate. I think that we have seen so many attacks, and this is a security measure to stop that. And I think that Arabs who want to see coexistence don't want to see one of their brethren blowing up or stabbing a Jew. And so our army is there in order to ensure that there's continued coexistence and normalcy in the city.
So do the Palestinians who live in Hebron have equality with the Israeli Jews who live in Hebron?
Well, they're part of a different state system. So the answer is they're not even in the same book. They have a Palestinian authority that controls them today.
But they're not a state by your own admission.
Whatever they are, they have voting within that. I think that the Palestinian Authority is a repressive regime, more akin to North Korea than anything else. And so, you know, they live under this horrifically repressive and regressive regime. They have this Palestinian Authority. Is it a state? Not a state. That's a separate question. But they wouldn't have equality in Israel because they're not part of the Israeli system.
But you want the Israeli state to...
That's in the future.
Be sovereign over the entire
region.
That's in the future. And we should also be accurate, because in all the rest of the West Bank, Judea, Samaria, the Israeli army has ultimate control over all areas. In other words, the Israeli army has the ultimate authority. If they want to enter Hebron, they do.
What's wrong with that?
No, I'm not really questioning whether what's wrong with it, but what we're talking about is who holds the ultimate authority. You're saying...
Well, security is not the same as equality. These are two, you're mixing things.
Okay.
These are two different things. You didn't ask me who's in charge of ultimate security. That's one thing. But what do you mean by equality anyway? Does it mean equality of the vote?
What do you mean?
You use the term. So what do you mean? To me...
Do you think there should be equality?
Well, I think... I'll answer that then. I think there should be liberty. The word equality is not a Middle East term. It's important to understand when liberal-minded folks, many liberal Jews...
You're looking right at me now.
Many liberal Jews talk about, like, for example, equality. They mean equality of the vote. And I always ask people like Peter Beinart, I always write to him and say, what Arab country has the vote? And the answer is not a one. Not one has the vote in any meaningful way whatsoever. So we just signed the contracts, a peace agreements with Bahrain, and which is a Shiite island dominated by a few Sunnis. We signed it with the UAE, which is nowhere near a liberal democracy. Saudi Arabia, etc. But the truth is not one Arab country has anything of a semblance of a liberal democracy. So to talk about it in these terms is true cultural appropriation.
No, but you want Israel to be the sovereign here.
Wait, that's a different problem. But my point is that when you talk about equality, that sounds like a nice word, but it's meaningless in the context of the Middle East, where there's no such thing as equality. Every state is a ethnic national state. Every one of them deals harshly with folks that want to undermine them, et cetera, et cetera. And so what I'm interested in is liberty, not equality. I think this is Israel is an ethnic national Jewish state designed to protect the rights of the Jewish people who are a minority in this region. We are 6.5 million Jews here amongst 400 million Arabs in 22 Arab countries. I never thought from the get-go that Israel is supposed to be a state of equality. It's supposed to be an ethnic national state, which 100 years ago was the height of liberalism, an idea that nations lived in their ethnic national land. And that was called the birth of nations, the spring of nations.
So if it's not supposed to have equality, is it even supposed to be a democracy? Because you have an article on your site that says that the Jewish democratic equation is artificial.
Well, when you use a term such as Jewish and democratic, and I'll just put it to you on a blackboard as a math problem. Jewish means ethnic national. Democratic means not ethnic national. How do you hybridize those two things, which are essentially in conflict? They're not. There's no way to harmonize those two conflicting ideas.
So which should take precedence in your mind?
For me, certainly it's very simple. Israel is an ethnic national state created to both buttress Jewish culture, defend us on our land, and ensure that the Jews aren't persecuted anymore in this region or around the world. It's an ethnic national state. It's so simple, really. It's really quite simple. And if you want a model, and there are many of them, think of Japan. Japan is democratic in the sense that Japanese, ethnic, national Japanese people have a right to vote. But if you ever moved there and tried to get equality, they would just laugh at you, because that island is trying to protect its ethnic national identity and its language and its culture. And it doesn't want you, a white person, to come and start to effectuate change there. So Israel is Jewish first. It has democratic principles in the sense that Jews... or maybe we could open it up to lovers of Israel or pro-Jewish, pro-Israel people could effectuate the policies and the direction of the country. But it's certainly not to be put on par, Jewish and democratic, as though we're going to be the only democratic country here. We're going to be the only ones that give the Arabs the right to vote. And we will be so blind as to see that the Arabs will use that vote to undermine our Jewish ethnic national state. So it's absurd. It's such an absurd thing. And so I put it as a math problem. It's an unsolvable math problem. And if you look really at the Declaration of Independence, there really is no mention of this term Jewish and democratic. It doesn't say that.
Actually, it doesn't even mention democracy in the Declaration.
Right, it really does not. And it makes perfect sense. And if you go back to an even more foundational document, which is the British mandate, the UN, the League of Nations mandate that was given to the British, it's very clear that the state of Israel is not supposed to compromise the religious and the civil rights of the local population, meaning to say you have to grant them civil rights and decencies.
So how does that not include equality?
And how, well, could, because,
and
because
how does that
civil
not include
rights,
the right to vote?
Because that's not what the framers of that document meant. They meant, as opposed to giving them equal democracy, make sure that you let them have their right to pray where they want to pray and say what they want to say and get together the way they want to get together and have their commerce and all that kind of stuff. But it means to say, what that language meant back then, it was very clear, like, we're creating an ethnic national state for the Jews, but don't be mean to some of the folks living there. That's what it means. It doesn't mean give them equality in your state. That's absurd. The whole point is that Israel was being harried. The Jewish people were being harried all over Europe and the Middle East. And here was going to be a protectorate, a small plot of land, which was under historical homeland. And so this was a state in order to protect and defend and help propagate the Jewish story.
So back in the early 20th century, they were talking about creating a future state where the Jews could have a refuge. Now that the Jews have had that state for 72 years now, do you justify the view that there should not be equality in the same way that you, what we were just discussing? There should not be equality for the non-Jewish citizens?
I again cannot even agree to the term equality, because okay, there's no such term in the Middle East. What I am in favor of is liberty.
Yes, you started to talk about
liberty.
That. Explain the
liberty
distinction.
Liberty is very different than equality. You know, in America, and it's, you know, a lot of times we frame everything from our American democratic context, but there's so many other democratic context.
We should just confess here that we both have an American background.
That's right. No, but that really colors a lot of how American Jewry and American liberal people see in general this thing, because they see it from their very, I would say, myopic perspective, and they've never taken a comparative democracy or comparative constitutional class in their life. And so they don't have a sense of how other countries run it, which they run it very, very differently. There's a lot of ethnic states. If it's Poland, if it's Hungary, you know, if it's Iceland or whatever it is, there's a million, not a million, over half of the states in the world are ethnic national states. That's number one.
But
number two.
But tell us about the liberty versus
equality. So an example in America is that you have people, green card holders, residents. Now, they still are under the Bill of Rights. They still have civil rights. They have liberties. They're allowed to congregate. They're allowed to make their own newspaper. They're allowed to say what they want to say. But that doesn't mean that they're equal citizens in the... How many of those? 60 million.
But have a path to citizenship. The green card is a way to become a citizen, which would give them voting rights. Is that what you're proposing for non-Jewish citizens of Israel?
That is one of the options. But I'm not saying that we have to mimic America exactly. I'm just giving an example that even in the great democracy of the United States, there are suddenly these things that are not like the way you expected them. There isn't exactly equality. Let's take another example, Puerto Rico. 2 million people living in Puerto Rico. They pose no danger to the United States. They cannot vote for president of the United States. They vote for congressmen and senators who are non-voting congressmen and senators. So their voice is heard, but they simply do not have power to sway America. Why? Why are these 2 million people in a different status? Because they are. They're in a territory, not a state. And therefore, they find themselves in a different status. Israel is a country under fire. And so we have people that have a different status here. And so I wouldn't talk about equality because I'm not here to give equality to Arabs. Just like Arabs aren't really there to give equality to me in any one of their countries. And what I am here to do is to give decent people decent opportunities for upward mobility, for great education, for great medicine, for wealth, for health, for great hospitals and great roads and great water. That's my vision. Those are people who are residents of the state of Israel, residents as opposed to citizens. They live here and they thrive here. Now, when I speak to real Arabs,
What are real Arabs?
Okay, real Arabs are not the ones like Saeb Erekat or Mahmoud Abbas, who are millionaires, making tons and tons of money.
Can Arabs be millionaires?
Oh, they surely can. I have no problem with that. But they are millionaires. But you cut me off from where? From Euro money that they have embezzled over the years, all through the contrived conflict that they have created. They themselves send their children to their death and to endless conflict. They thrive off of conflict. And this is not me saying that. Ask any Arab. Dalia, do me a favor. I know you know this. Ask any Arab in the Palestinian street. They'll tell you these are, as they say in Hebrew, mushhatim. They are corrupt leaders, okay? They fly in jets while asking for money for their folks.
I'm not going to argue corruption. But my only question was why that makes them into unreal anything.
Because they do not represent
So you think
the real people on the street. They do not represent them. And that's why they don't have the vote.
But go back to your point.
Every time they say this over and over again in a meeting that I just had this Thursday night with Palestinian Arabs from Hebron, they say, we just want Israeli residency. We get your concerns and understand our concerns. We just want to be protected by Israel and have the liberty to make money, to live and have welfare. And so just give us Israeli residency. And
so you think that's what should happen in this area where Israel has settlements in Judea, Samaria, the West Bank. And what about Gaza?
Look, Gaza, the answer is, with Gaza, when you make a horrific mistake, you have to pay for it for a long time. And so when we did the absurd of the unilateral giveaway of our land to forces who were already jihadist, but then were taken over by the Hamas, and now we have had 3 physical wars and endless mini wars that we pay protection money to so they don't shoot at us. That's what happens when you do a stupid thing. So I don't have an answer for you about Gaza, except for learn the lesson, don't do that again, because that's really, really dumb.
Oh, I think we should take a pause.
Just before we pause, let's understand that I'm sitting in Jewish Hebron right now, and next to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, and what you're hearing is the call to prayer, the Muslim call to prayer, which blares out 5 times a day here. And this building is a shared Jewish synagogue and mosque. And it could be a beautiful coexistence if it wasn't for the jihadist elements that are here.
you were talking about the distinction between liberty and equality, and you were talking about the difference between residency and voting rights. And I understand that. And I want to go back to something that you said earlier, because then it will lead us into future political frameworks for how to live together. You said you don't want anybody else to have sovereignty between Israel, let's say sovereign Israel now, and the Jordan River, anywhere east of Israel now. So what does that mean?
Anywhere west of the Jordan River.
West of the Jordan River, east of Israel now. You consider this also Israel now. Okay. So why do you not think that any other, that the people who live here, the people who are from here, who've been born here and who've been born here for generations, the Palestinians, why do they not have a right to self-determination?
Well, let's say you take an example like Chinatown. There are, if you go to Chinatown, the signs are in Chinese. People speak Chinese, Chinese medicine, Chinese food. But if any, and they're Chinese people, Chinese ethnic Chinese people, if they called and said, well, but this is now part of, this is part of the sovereignty of the state of China, we would be shocked and appalled by that. So I have no problem at all with other peoples living here. I mean, if anything, this region is the Arab people's region. We live in their region. We, you know what I mean? They're the vast majority, 400 million.
But you know, I'm going to tell you that there is no Palestinian state. So
good. I don't want there to be a Palestinian state.
Why not?
Because this is my land. That's the simplest refrain of them all, which a lot of people get confused about. And the simple answer to your question is, but it's my land. It's not their land.
But they say it's their land.
And I disagree with them firmly. Okay. That's what it is. And we can anchor it in a lot of history and a lot of stuff. But that's the bottom line. If you ask me, why don't I want anybody else here? It's not because they're going to make war against me. And it's not because of various reasons. It's simply because it's not their land. It's not their land. It's unjust. And it would be a type of theft. And it would lead to endless war. But it's just plain wrong.
Even
it's
though
not
their families have been living here for generations.
Means nothing.
And
they've never had a state here. There's no state. And by the way, even the term Palestinians and all that is a relatively new term. And there's tons and tons of material.
So is Israel
that,
for that matter. Huh? So
no, Israel's an ancient
as
term.
As a sovereign state.
No. See, to equate that is to show the I would say an ignorant equation. Which you would equate a Palestine, which is the Arabs came to this region in a conquest in 637. They were ousted by the...
That's a long time ago.
No, it's 1400 years ago. They were then ousted, those Arabs were ousted by the Crusaders. And the Crusaders were then ousted by the Mamluks. And the Mamluks were ousted by the Turks. And the Turks were ousted finally by the Brits. And the Brits gave it away. They were supposed to create a Jewish state here. And then the Jordanians pushed in. Then the Jordanians were pushed out. There's been no Palestinian sovereign here. But there have been two Jewish commonwealths here.
They
okay,
were,
previously.
That was even
oh,
way
so so a long time ago
yeah.
It was cool for Arabs, but it's not cool for Jews.
No, but I'm saying if it's the
here's
opposite.
Here's the point.
I'm
we've had two. I, wait, we've had wanna, two commonwealths okay. here. We'd have had two historic commonwealths here. There has never been a historic Palestine here, and the word historic Palestine is one of the narrative war created mythologies. There's never been a historic Palestine. There have been people living here, just like there are people living in various parts of the world. That doesn't give them the right to self-determination. And I will fight that idea that this group should have self-determination in our land.
Well, I mean, there are many other groups that have self-determination in other lands. Why would you say Palestinians should not have self-determination? I mean, is it just because you consider this your land?
That's a good reason.
Or is it that you don't want them to have self-determination in general?
I have nothing against them for their own successes. In fact, I would love to see, you know, Arabs more successful in this whole region. I'd like to see them thrive. And I know that when they thrive, we'll thrive. Just like when there's trade between the U.S. and Canada. I want them to thrive. And anybody that follows my Twitter feed or my relationships with Arab sees, I have no avarice towards and no malice towards the Arab peoples. It's just that this is my tribal lands and that's their tribal lands. It's not some kind of racism or something like that. They are my cousins. They speak a similar language to me. We have almost an identical genetic code. It's just not their land. That's all. And any tribes, Arab tribes, often have conflicts over borders. We have a conflict over a border.
Okay,
they're claiming
this
is their land, and we say absolutely not.
Right. So there's a big disagreement. It's a zero-sum disagreement. You say it's our land. They say it's also ours. Why
can't they, by the way? Because they is not. I will disagree about who the they is. That the Palestinian Authority and Hamas certainly make these claims, but the Arabs right here, right here, this neighborhood of Jabri, right next to us, 40,000 people, they have a completely different take. They think that the Palestinian Authority is corrupt. They think that it's oppressive. They think that Israel ruling here is the right thing.
They want to be Israeli residents. That means they don't want self-determination. And as a pollster, I'm going to pull rank and say most Palestinians do want self-determination. And the question is,
I don't believe that.
Okay, well, you can do a poll too. But my question
is, I have done a poll, but my poll isn't scientific, but it's dealing with people day in, day out. I don't believe what you're saying.
Okay, but let me ask you this. Why can't there be a compromise in the middle? You're saying the whole land is mine. They're saying the land is ours. Why wouldn't you say, let's meet halfway?
Because that's not the rules of the Middle East. That talk itself is a very Western imposition on how things work around here. And that's my biggest claim. You know, when I hear, you know, liberal folks coming around, I was in Washington, D.C., and I was hanging out with a guy who's a Kurd and a Kurdish activist in Washington. And he was dealing with the Kurdish folks in Iran and that whole region, because, you know, the Kurds spread out in Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq, they're out there. And he deals with more of the Iran side. So I said to him, friend, your problem is obvious. If you would just give some of your land to Iran, then you'll have peace. And we laughed. He knew exactly that I was joking, because it's such an absurd type of commentary. It's such an absurd thought around
it. But Iran does have its own state already.
It's completely besides the point. The point is that there are elements that are jihadist elements that want to swallow you and destroy you. They use liberal language today in order to get what they want, but they don't really want that. They want the end of Israel. There is not one Palestinian Authority map with two states. It doesn't exist. To them, and I've seen their published maps many times, and I've been in their offices, there's only one map, and that's the whole zero-sum game. That's the whole land of Israel.
Okay, that's okay. I haven't seen the green line on Israeli maps ever until Corona.
First thing, that's absurd. I've seen many a two-state line, two-state maps drawn. But on top of that, great. I'm not here to sell two-state. Okay. I'm not here to sell compromise with the Palestinian Authority.
Let's talk about some of the articles that you've written about this issue, because you really have been very outspoken against the two-state solution, what some people call the two-state solution. Mm-hmm. You've written about a range of other solutions that are out there. I don't want you to walk through every single one because we don't have time, but it's in a New York Times op-ed for anybody who wants to read it, and other articles of yours.
Right.
And what I want to know is, what are the basic principles that you think should be in place in any of the solutions that would be considered acceptable to you?
Great. First thing is, I want to say that decent Arabs who want a decent life, decent I mean non-jihadist, who have a non-jihadist or post-jihadist attitude. I think I just coined that term right now. I like that very much. Post-jihadist attitude, which means to say you may have been jihadist, but you've come to the conclusion. Oh my gosh, I love it. You've come to the conclusion that you can't really defeat Israel.
And so jihadist means you're trying to defeat Israel.
Yes, jihadist
anybody
means
who's trying to defeat Israel. Jihadist is a
state of mind, which is a religious state of mind and very well defined. I'm not making it up. In Islam, there's an idea of Dar al-Harb, the area that is yet to be conquered, the area of the sword, and Dar al-Salam, like the capital in Tanzania, which is what the area that has already been conquered. It's already peaceful because it's Islamic. So that's a jihadist attitude, and I understand that. But Israel's got to put up as Jabotinsky once wrote, an iron wall, not a physical wall, but
We have a wall. I don't think you want it.
No. I want a wall, which the UAE is clearly now accepting, which is, you'll never defeat us. You'll never beat us. We're never leaving, like ever, ever, ever. And so therefore, your war with us is doubly sad, because you're going to lose your children to it, and you're not going to gain anything, and you're going to retard your own progress.
But if I understand you correctly, you are saying that their struggle for self-determination is a war on Israel, because all
Correct.
Of this land is Israel. Okay?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so continue. That's what are
part
the guiding
of the
principles?
The local jihadist mindset is that we're going to defeat Israel. And they say it all the time. You can look at their news feeds all the time. They will defeat Israel. You know, F Israel, free Palestine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a daily fodder on Twitter. So so the first is that decent, non-jihadist, post-jihadist Arabs will have decencies and liberties, okay? Which means that they will really just, an example of that, and I don't want you to get me exactly on the question of voting, not voting, but like the Druze living in our country. I don't want you to get me right now on the question.
Because the Druze, of course,
vote. But that's not
I'm just pointing it out for listeners who won't know that. The Druze are citizens of Israel in Israel's sovereign borders,
Correct.
And they do vote.
Right. And what's the big difference between a Druze and an Arab? Ethnically, they're practically the same. The difference is the software they run. And the software is loyalty versus jihadism. So the loyalty attitude, if it comes from Arabs or Druze or anybody else, great. Loyal residents, loyal citizens, we could discuss that. Pathway to citizenship, fine. But the point is that loyalty is the key thing here. And that's understandable, by the way. At the UAE, it's the same exact thing. Like, you better damn be loyal or else, you know? So we have a defensive state. We want folks to be loyal. But those who are loyal, boy, will they reap an excellent opportunity to live a fabulous life, maybe the best life in the Middle East. That's the first line, which is non-jihadism is going to be acceptable, but jihadism is not. That's number one. Number two is that we should be creative. And we should be creative in our thinking. For example, the nearby state, the next door neighbor state is Jordan. And Jordan was originally cut out in 1923 by the British from a landmass that was supposed to be Jewish. And they created it for their friends, the Hashemites. But today, 80% of the folks living there self-identify as Palestinian. So we say, the original two-state solution has already been in place. The Jordan was the one that brought most of the Arabs that are here today in Judea and Samaria and the West Bank in 1948 after they took over and occupied this land for 19 years. We say Arabs living here in the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, should get their citizenship back from Jordan and continue to live here in Israel as residents. Live as residents, get all the status of residency, of course, only if you're non-jihadist, but vote or whatever in your actual Palestinian state,
which
is next door.
But that wouldn't be the state that controls their lives because they would be living under Israel.
It's time to be creative, Dahlia. It's time to be a little bit creative. It's time to step out. Like, let's, you know, if we're already the innovation nation, let's innovate a little bit, okay? And democracy is much more open source than the way that American Jews a lot of times think it is. Like this, like, very, very boxed in thing. It's really not. A little bit of study, like 15 minutes of internet work of understanding comparative democracy shows that there are different ways that it's done in different places. And so we have a situation. We have a youth that has been trained. We have a population and a youth that have been trained for the last 100 years to hate Israel. Arabs that have converted out of that, that have become post-jihadists, tell me all the time, they're like, we are trained to hate Israel in our mother's milk. Okay? They tell me that. I don't say that. They say that to me all the time. And so it's going to take some more time for this attitude to leave. But in the meantime, we cannot endanger the state of Israel, the Jewish people, by being so married to liberal values that we're, you know, cutting off our nose to spite our face. And so therefore, we have to be creative. So I gave you just one example. You poo-pooed it very quickly.
But no, I asked you a question.
But I think it's worth it to consider.
To
it's worth it to consider how we can run the country in a different way. How do we give the most amount of people decencies? And I'm going to say something very so-called, in Israel we call it right-wing. It doesn't sound so good in the Anglosphere, but nationalism, whatever you want to call it. I'm going to say something very nationalist. I believe that a bigger Israel means more rights for more people. I actually want to ensure the decency of life of the peoples that live under the Israeli sovereignty, in their various modalities, if it's residency or other.
As long as it's not self-determination.
Absolutely. Self-determination means somebody else wants to take over this land and call it their own. I will not allow that. I just said exactly the opposite, which is, as a nationalist, I want to expand Israel's borders to its natural borders. And then I want the folks here who are decent and loyal and want upward mobility to have those opportunities. I want them to be able to tell the world, we are happy, we are satisfied living here. Those, by the way, Arabs that want self-determination and want to find that, I say, ahlan wa sahlan, please go ahead. Find it in your other 22 other countries, Arab countries.
Okay.
You'll go somewhere else. If you feel a great need to fight Israel or to have your own self-determination, your place is not here.
Okay. What is the role of settlements in that process, if you want to get to one of these kinds of solutions?
I really like that question a lot. And I don't think I've heard that question phrased that way, but I like it a lot. And the reason I like it is because what people don't understand a lot of times is that the settlements are the avant-garde of the Zionist movement today. And so where we go, we're leading the way today. And you could see that, by the way, with the Pompeo declaration that Jews living in Judea and Samaria is no longer to be seen as illegal under international law, under the State Department's understanding. And so we have led the way. We have pushed into this historic homeland. We have resettled it. And we are the ones crafting the way forward towards what you would call peace. I don't particularly like that word. I like coexistence, harmony, collaboration, regional realignment. The word peace has become sullied to me.
The description that you just gave in the previous question is much clearer. I don't think we need a name for it. What you're describing is what you hope settlements will help to bring about.
Absolutely. And that's right. But what I meant to say, what I meant to add at the very end there is that we're the ones that have a vision for peace. That's what I'm trying to say. We are the ones today, and I'm involved in many what could be termed as right-wing or nationalist groups who are meeting with Arabs on nationalist principles, Israeli Jewish nationalist principles, and trying to figure out a way to create decency and opportunity and a way forward for them. And I'm much more excited about coming to peace from strength. I hate these very, you know, blasé terms, but they're out there. But I believe that peace through strength is real. And I could see through my very real relationships with Arabs that they want it, they accept it. And I think the Abraham Accords is certainly clear that there's going to be now an understanding that trying to carve out a Palestine out of Israel is not the way forward.
Yishai Fleischer, international spokesperson for the Jewish community of Hebron, thank you for talking to me about settler life and ideology.
Thank you very much, Dalia.
You've been listening to this special limited series on Israeli settlements in partnership with the Israel Office of the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. I'm Dalia Shenlin. Thank you for listening.